and to come here and tell us something about digital humanities. I think all of us know that digital humanities is a key word which, at least in our country, is quite fashionable, even in the circles of the Ministry of Education. So we may get some insight and also some suggestions how to propagate digital humanities in our environment. Please take the floor.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you very much, of course, for the invitation. It's me who has to thank for getting the opportunity to speak to you. And I think I can skip the introduction because Eva just pointed out why digital humanities is so is such a hot topic currently. And what I've been working on for a couple of time now is trying to get a better grip on what exactly digital humanities means or could mean. And actually, if you go to some digital humanities conference, you will inevitably have discussions about the right definition of digital humanities. It's kind of an ongoing, very much debated things, and there is even a book defining digital humanities. But of course, it's since we are talking about humanities here, it's 300 pages and not actually a definition in there, but mostly different views. And there is also a very nice website, whatisdigitalhumanities.com, which each time you visit the site, it gives you another definition of digital humanities from a pool of about, I think, 800 definitions or so. And some of them are pretty wild definitions. Some are, you probably could agree with them, but there is a huge variety of different definitions. So, you could, of course, ask, well, do we really need a definition? And there are some people who say, well, no, I mean, we're a big tent, everyone is invited, and we can all be friends. And of course, this is good, but this is not a definition either. And I think we need a definition of what digital humanities is, because if you want to create a program of studies, for example, or if you want to devise a research agenda, you have to commit yourself to some kind of definition. You have to say what direction your research wants is supposed to go, or what you want to teach your students. And the problem currently with most definitions that you find in the literature or that you hear at conferences and so on, is that they mostly focus on methods and say very little about goals. And a closely related problem is the question that people also like to discuss at length, is whether digital humanities are a discipline of their own, an interdisciplinary field, a community of practice, or something completely different. The only thing maybe where there's a relatively broad consensus is that the digital humanities somehow bring together computer science and humanities. So there must be there are inherently two aspects in this thing. Namely, one thing is that there is work on humanities research questions using methods and tools from computer science, and there is the other side, work on computer science methods and tools for tackling research questions in the humanities. So the term digital humanities is inherently ambiguous, and it could, as it's currently used, it could mean either of these or something else. And I won't go through 800 definitions of digital humanities now, so I just picked one definition at random. It just happens that it's from my 2012 book, Natural Language Processing for Historical Texts, where in the opening chapter I try to outline how natural language processing and digital humanities and historical texts could come to each other. And there I give a definition of what I thought at that time were digital humanities. It says, the emerging field of digital humanities aims to exploit the possibilities offered by digital data for humanities research. The digital humanities combine traditional qualitative methods with quantitative computer-based methods and tools, such as information retrieval, text analytics, data mining, visualization, and geographic information systems. And it's, I don't show this definition here because it's outstanding, but it's rather typical of, at least if you look at the reasonable definitions, this is something like this is what you're probably gonna find. But after some while of thinking about what we actually mean by digital humanities and working in this area, I thought, well, here I say it's a combination of qualitative and quantitative methods. That's what digital humanities are. And I thought, no, this is not really true, because there are some aspects to what you would like to consider digital humanities that are not quantitative in nature. For example, the creation of resources such as digital editions, which provide you with text that you could then apply NLP to. So this is not quantitative. So I revised my definition in 2013 and introduced the differentiation between digital humanities in the narrow sense and digital humanities in a wider sense. Digital humanities in the narrow sense is basically the definition from 2012, which says in the narrow sense, digital humanities refers to the application of quantitative computer-based methods for humanities research, usually complementing traditional qualitative methods. And I introduced the new secondary definition in a wider sense. It may also refer to the application of computer-based tools in humanities research, not necessarily involving quantitative methods. And I give the example of creating a digital edition of historical texts or literary texts of something that is not digital humanities in the narrow sense, because it does not involve quantitative methods, but it is in the wider sense. And for some time, I was quite happy with this definition, because, and I thought, well, now that's it. I've nailed it. But after some more time working in this field and thinking about digital humanities, I felt that this definition does have some flaws, after all. First of all, it's actually only a description of practices. As I said, it's quite a typical definition, as it focuses on methods and tools and practices, but it doesn't really say why you want to do this or what the advantage would be of using quantitative methods or not, and or computer-based tools. And the most serious problem, actually, perhaps, is that this definition implies, both the from 2012 and the revised definition implies, that there are two kinds of humanities: digital humanities, whatever this is, and non-digital, perhaps analog humanities. And these are two separate disciplines or fields or whatever. And I believe, or it occurred to me, that this cannot be true, because all humanities disciplines like literary studies, history, philosophy, musicology, and so on, what you have, they have their specific objects of research. So dealing with literary texts or historical texts or music or images of art and so on, they have their specific objects of research, and they use whatever methods are needed or are appropriate. So this means the humanities disciplines are defined by their research objects, not by their methods. So you make a distinction between literary studies and history of art, because one studies literary texts and their production and their circumstances of their production, and the other studies images or of the fine arts. And the methods don't really are not really important there. And you see in all humanities disciplines that there is a mix of methods. And even in traditional studies, you can find quantitative methods used. Maybe not computer-based, maybe only on a small scale, but you certainly do have quantitative methods in history, for example. I was kind of dissatisfied with my definitions, and I'm a computation linguist by training, and it occurred to me, maybe I should look at the history of computational linguistics again, because linguistics, if you consider linguistics a discipline of the humanities, then certainly has a vantage point for observing whatever is happening in the digital humanities, because linguistics has essentially completed the transition from armchair linguistics to a pretty hard empirical science using formal methods. And I thought maybe this could teach us something, or this could be helpful for defining digital humanities. And this is, you could, if you look at computational linguistics from a very high point of view, you could say there are two types types of activities that are covered by this term. On the one hand, you have theoretical computational linguistics, which also used to be called mathematical linguistics, and I've seen this institute very much has this tradition of mathematical linguistics, which covers fields like formal language theory, grammar theories, and these kinds of things. And on the other hand, you have applied computational linguistics, which is sometimes it's called corpus linguistics, sometimes natural language processing, where you use, where you apply these theories and methods to some concrete language, such as Czech or German or English, and actually write grammars. And so you can say this: you have a theory of formal modeling for linguistics, and you have the application of formal modeling in linguistics. So, you could really say, so what I call theoretical linguistics or mathematical linguistics is actually math or computer science, but in that area. And the applied computational linguistics here, even though it may have a different department or in the university, you could say, it's actually linguistics because the research questions are linguistics. You want to know how some construction works in German, and you're writing a formal grammar in order to study to study German or Czech and in order to study the construction and your description of it. So this is what I just said. And now, theoretical computational linguistics studies the means and methods of constructing formal models in linguistics, and applied computational linguistics concerned with the construction of formal models of natural languages and with the methodology of constructing such models. The question is, so the first one is actually a meta science, because it studies the methods that are used for some for some other research, whereas the applied computational linguistics is a science. Now, can we apply this to digital humanities as well? Does this help us? I think yes, it does. And I came up with the brand new pretty new to 2016 definitions. And instead of one definition with two sub-definitions, I have two separate definitions, and I define digital humanities as the study of the means and methods of constructing formal models in the humanities. And I have a second definition, or actually a set of definitions, and I'm using history as an example because I've worked at a historical institute. So digital history is concerned with the construction of formal models of historical circumstances and with the methodology of constructing such models. So this means that digital history creates concrete formal models of its research objects. So you have a particular historical research question. What was the cause for World War I, for example? This could be a research question. It's a popular one. Actual historians are, of course, working with much more fine-grained research questions, but something like this is a historical research question, certainly. And you're creating formal models to study this particular question. And correspondingly, of course, you could say, well, you have the same thing in digital philology, digital musicology, etc. You could call it applied digital humanities. And these are not disciplines of their own, but these are just subfields of their disciplines, or if you want to call it a subfield. It's just that you're doing some research in history using a particular set of methods when they're useful. And the digital humanities would then be what theoretical computational linguistics or mathematical linguistics are, a meta science. They are concerned with with construction materials that you need in order to build formal models in particular disciplines. And of course, just like in computational linguistics, there is no strict boundary between digital humanities and applied digital humanities. I put it in quotes because it's not an established term. And of course, if you're studying construction materials, you may also be interested in their application, and vice versa. If you're using these construction materials, you may also be interested in their properties and maybe do some research in a particular area that is of particular importance to your application. But this is the same thing as you have in computational linguistics. So here's some, you could call it example. I'm thankful to Karsten for giving me the example, but it's not fully worked out, so you have to take it with a grain of salt. But if you consider philological studies, where people construct or create editions of either literary or historical texts, and what they do in philology is usually they are annotating texts with information about what they find here, particular rhetorical structures or annotation of persons and their background and annotation of places and events diplomatics, that is how here is a delete, or this character was deleted, and later on somebody else, there's a second hand that wrote something over it, and a third hand that annotated the thing, and so on. These kinds of informations. And so you need some tag set, just like in computation or in linguistics. You need some tag sets to annotate the phenomena you're interested in. And of course, you need some annotation guidelines to say, well, if you find something crossed out, you mark it as crossed out, and you annotate the original content and the type of deletion, for example. And you could say, the definition of the text set and the definition of the annotation guidelines is what I would call, what you could call, a digital philology. This is research that is driven by philological needs and philological insights and philological practices or best practices and experience. On the other hand, if you're creating a digital edition, you're of course using technologies such as XML, XQuery. You're using either inline markup or you're using some type of standoff annotation for your text. And these types of technologies are certainly not a research topic in philology. And I don't think they should be a research topic in philology. But this is rather computer science. So you could ask, well, is then digital humanities, according to my definition, is this the same as computer science? I would say not quite. But rather, digital humanities, according to my definition, is computer science, is the intersection of computer science and the specifics of humanities. So you have the same situation as with mathematical linguistics or theoretical computational linguistics, whatever you want to call it, or a similar situation where you have you have some aspects of mathematics or computer science, formal language theory, but you're not necessarily interested in all of it, but you're interested in certain subsets that are of particular relevance to the study of linguistics. And the same is here. You're not interested in digital humanities. You're not interested in all of computer science, but you're interested in specific parts of it that are of particular importance to applications in the humanities. And some of these things that are of particular importance in most, if not all, humanities disciplines are representation of vagueness, handling of incomplete data, which is particularly important if you're dealing with historical stuff, because historical stuff is often incomplete, because half of the library burned, so you don't know what was in there, or or your manuscript is torn and you're missing one edge. You're dealing with uncertainty. You may not know whether something is original or fake. And of course, you have all kinds of specific requirements that result from the specific research questions, which do not come from computer science, but which come from humanities, And I think the most important part of computer science probably that you need in the digital humanities is knowledge representation. Because what you're doing is representing knowledge about text, knowledge about images, knowledge about music, knowledge about historical events, and these kinds of things. So now what is the... I want to talk a little bit about the role of formal models in the humanities, or where I see the application of formal models in the humanities. Because, of course, you could say something, if you know a bit about the history of science and philosophy, you could say, okay, yeah, I mean, back then, I don't know, Frege, for example, these guys, they wanted to formalize all science and didn't work out. Now, this is not what I'm proposing, obviously. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but just to give a little bit of a framework, some introductory words. So a model is a representation of a selected part of the world, and you could call it a description or a theory, but I think the term model is probably best, because theory in particular in the humanities has some connotation that you rather want to avoid. So I think that's why I'm using the term model. So we're talking about formal models, and so the question is, of course, the next question is, what does formal mean? And I have a very nice definition here from a 1969 book by Gladke and Melchuk, which I'm very fond of, and they say the word formal means nothing more than logically coherent plus unambiguous plus explicit. So there's really no magic in here, and in particular, there are different degrees, obviously different degrees of formalization. We all know this. You could have some semi-formal description of something and then formalize it even more. And of course, if we're talking about digital humanities, we are primarily interested in a degree of formalization that allows models to be processed and manipulated by computers. Just like in computational linguistics, that's the key. You could do it on paper, you could write formal grammars on paper and evaluate them, but it's much more fun if you have a computer do it for you. And not just more fun, but it's also allows you to do the really interesting things. Now, if you look at science and humanities, you can say that all disciplines construct models of their research. Because in order to understand a complex object, and with object I mean anything that is being researched, so this could be a phenomenon or a situation, it could be a historical situation or a historical event, for example, you need to understand its parts. So if you're talking about history, the persons and the places that play the role, and the documents and letters that were sent, and how they interrelate and interact with each other. And this is exactly what a model describes. However, in contrast, of course, to the natural sciences, models in the humanities are traditionally not formal, and thus not directly accessible, because they only exist in the scholar's head. And narratives, so this is what the main form of communication in history, in historical scholarship, is the narrative, which usually comes in the form of a monograph. These are not models, but they are actually informal descriptions of models. So the scholar has the model in his or her head, and then describes this model in a readable, nicely readable way in a narrative, and publish this as a book. So, now, if I say digital humanities is about formal models in the humanities, how do they fit into the research process? So the traditional research process could be said to look like this. So this is mostly about, I'm using history as an example, but it basically applies to other humanities disciplines as well. And of course, this is a very simple model, but I think it captures the essential parts of the historical research process. So I think I have some text for this as well. Yep. So you have a scholar, and the scholar reads and interprets primary and secondary sources. So this is a large part of the research work in history. And the facts that you extract from these sources and the insights that you gained by reading these sources are usually recorded as what I call working materials in a variety of forms. This could be notes scribbled on paper or typed into some Word documents or but they also exist in spreadsheets. Some of my historian colleagues are very fond of creating spreadsheets with the kind of, we could say, dramatis personae, so the act or families that play a role. Some of them create databases to record facts, publishing dates of documents and descriptions of their contents, all kinds of things. And then, after reading and evaluating all sources and creating the working materials, then the scholar constructs a mental model in order to answer the original research question, and then describes this model in a narrative. One big problem with this process is, and this is the reason why historical scholarship, for example, advances at a much slower pace than, for example, particle physics, is that building on the work of others is pretty difficult. Because now here you have the first scholar who produced the narrative, and then you have a second scholar who wants to work on a similar topic and maybe wants to use the knowledge or the insights or wants to build on the work of the scholar before him. So this basically means that this book here, produced by the first researcher, goes into the stack of sources, just like all the primary and other secondary sources, and has to be read and interpreted in the same way that the primary sources have to be interpreted. And of course, all interpretation processes are prone to errors or to interpretations that differ from the original intention. So what you have, you could start here. Here, in this head, you have the full model. This is a description of a model which may leave some parts away because they don't make for a good narrative. So you leave this away. And then this scholar reads this description and constructs his own mental model, trying. Of course, the original intention is to try and reconstruct this model here. Of course, this. Historians don't say this. I'm trying to reconstruct the mental model of Professor X, but this is essentially what they do. You try to understand what this author meant by writing something, and you come at your own conclusions, which of course you put again down into in your working materials, and then revise and read, and then in the end produce your own narrative, which of course in some way builds on this one, but the connection is not a very direct one. So, now, I'm not saying, you could think that I'm proposing to replace the narrative with a formal model. And of course, you could say, historians should stop writing books and they should instead publish their research results as formal models. Now, no, this is not what I'm proposing. But I think the role of the formal models in the humanities is where you were used to have these working materials, and this is the point where you gather all the information and knowledge that you extracted from these sources, and you're representing them in a formal way. And so this formal is not magic. But it just means that you're being explicit. And instead of making some vague allusions, you're saying, okay, I have this person here, and this person is identical to that person, and you're just putting down your notes in some way that a computer can handle, basically. And then, of course, as I said, this formal model here does not replace the narrative, because the narrative is something that is targeted at humans, and as a human, you're much more likely to enjoy reading a good book rather than parsing prologue facts or something. So this is not replaced, but the narrative is something that comes out of this formal model. This is, again, of course, just like it's like a narrative today is based on your working notes. Your narrative is based on, again, on your working notes, just that you formulate your notes in a way that a computer can manipulate them. So you still have the traditional narrative, but as a bonus, you can also, since the formal model is can be processed by the computer, you can do all kinds of other things with it as well. For example, you can process it automatically and create all kinds of new analyses, visualizations, whatever. And these, for example, a visualization may help you actually to refine your model. This is why the arrows go in both ways. And you may see that something was missing in your model, and you may want to add this or correct this, because it's very hard to automatically analyze your handwritten notes automatically and draw some conclusions from it. But you can do it if you write down your notes in a way that the computer can process, and then the computer can show you that there are inconsistencies or missing things or noteworthy things. For example, that most of the documents that you read are from a certain period of time, and this may be what you intended, but may also indicate that there is a skew in the sources that you evaluated, and you may want to evaluate some more sources or earlier sources or later sources or these kinds of things. And the other thing is that this would actually bring collaboration in the humanities on a higher level. Because instead of going through narratives and analyzing and interpreting narratives, if you have, again, these two researchers, you could directly connect these formal models to each other, so link them. And of course, again, this goes both ways. So insights gained by this researcher from his sources and recorded in his model may again help the first researcher to refine her model, or to expand it, or to correct it. So this is when I am talking about formal models in the humanities, this is basically what I have in mind. These are some additional points I'd like to make regarding the question of quantitative methods, which I had in my first definition, and in many definitions you find are quantitative methods are very prominent in these definitions. But actually, if you look at it, humanities research questions and results are primarily qualitative. And this also means that digital humanities are primarily qualitative. Of course, this does not exclude the use of quantitative methods. It's just that you don't have quantitative results, but you have qualitative results in the end. You may use a variety of methods to reach these results. And I state again that I think also for this reason that knowledge representation is central for the creation of formal models in the humanities. Just like theory of formal languages is important for linguistic models, but of course you could also say this is also kind of knowledge representation, because you're representing grammatical knowledge in the form of rules or statistical models. But in the digital humanities, it's less about grammars, but more about knowledge representation in a classical AI sense, if you want. Just a few words on the role of natural language processing, because of course because I'm a computational linguist, and of course this is a question that often comes up, or that of course natural language processing is something that people who use digital methods in the humanities want to do, because they automatically want to analyze their sources and do stuff with it. And so this is also, you wonder how natural language processing fits in. And my take on it is, if the humanities seriously want to base their research on large quantities of text and quantitative methods that natural language processing gives you, they will need natural language processing as a basis for all higher level analyses. And it's the important thing is that the humanities history, for example, is of course not interested in linguistic structures. They are interested in the semantic part. They are not interested in how something, usually they are not interested in the grammatical structures that are used in some historical document, but in the implications of it. What does it mean? But of course, in order to analyze meaning in whatever way you want to tackle this problem, you first need to understand the underlying syntactic and morphological structures. Certainly, natural language processing plays a very important role in digital history and other applied digital humanities. And this means, again, this is from the view of point of view of history. This means for digital historical scholarship, natural language processing must then be regarded as a so-called auxiliary science of history. This is not a negative term. It's just the point of view of historians. From their point of view, these are auxiliary sciences because they feed into history. Similar to long established auxiliary sciences such as diplomatics, codicology, paleography, numismatics, sigillography, etc., which are indispensable for evaluating and using historical sources and interpreting them correctly. And just like I have a nice quote here from 1970, so also very, what you would call today a very old quote, from Jacques Froger, a French historian, who said that it's not necessary that the philologist writes the program himself or herself, even you would like them to do this. But what is important that they have enough knowledge of programming languages so that they can control the work of the programmer. Because the programmer may not be familiar with the particular problems that the philologist may have. And of course, what you need to add here is you have the same problem, of course, vice versa, namely that the historian or the philologist may not be aware of the possibilities and limitations of the technology. And of course, this also applies to natural language processing. So if you want to use NLP methods in historical scholarship, for example, of course you don't necessarily have to write the parser yourself, but you should be aware of what is in there and what you may be able to get out of it, and where sources of errors may be, and where what opportunities you have and what limitations are there, and what kinds of data you may need to provide in order to make an analysis possible, and these kinds of things. Okay. I see that I still have some time, so I just... This is a bit... I'm going to talk a bit about some recent work of my own, which was, of course, not originally based on this definition, because it's a new definition, but where I now find retrospectively that it confirms that this is well, maybe not the right definition, but that this definition of digital humanities goes in the right direction, at least I think so. And also, this is just to give you an impression of what we've been, or what I've been up to at the Leibniz Institute of European History in the area of digital humanities. So this is the first example is actually a digital edition, and it goes back to my previous employment at the Law Sources Foundation of the Swiss Lawyer Society in Zurich. And this is a digital edition of the Appenzeller Landbuch, which is one of the oldest surviving Swiss legal documents. And most of this digital edition is actually pretty vanilla, you could say. You have the structure of the document, and you have a transcription of the document, and you have a facsimile. But what actually sets this edition apart from many other digital editions is that we try to formally model not everything, but places, persons, and organizations, that is, groups of persons that belong together. And this, a part of that is what you can see here. So I admit that it's just I'm just hinting at it. But I also think that this is actually a good place to start, because if you're reading historical sources, you find persons, you find names of persons, and you're trying to connect these persons to persons mentioned elsewhere, and you're trying to get at the interactions that there are. And this is a very it's in a way easier than to grasp the semantics of some document, but you have something more concrete to work with, and it's actually something very useful, because if you encounter these same persons in another document, then you can immediately make a connection between these documents, and you can build up networks of persons and their movement or between different places when they are mentioned to have lived in one place, and then they are mentioned in a later document they are mentioned to have lived at some other place. You already have lots of information that are not only useful for yourself or for your own research, but which is something that others can make use of, and where others can also contribute their own information that they have from different documents, and immediately you have some connection between these two research projects. This is some more recent work, which is more, it's actually closer to formal modeling. The labeling system is some work that we've done in the context of Daria DE. You may have heard of Daria, the European research network for digital research infrastructure for the arts and humanities. That's what the acronym says, and Daria DE is the German contribution to this EU-wide project. And this is some work we've done together with colleagues at the University of Applied Sciences in Mainz. And the labeling system is an approach and a prototypical implementation of this approach that aims to improve the situation with respect to controlled vocabularies in the humanities. And controlled vocabularies are very important play a very important role for formal models, because they allow you to uniquely identify categories or types of knowledge. But the problem in the humanities is that that categories evolve, or the definition of category is something that usually is part of the research process itself. You may, at the beginning of your research project, you may think, well, okay, so there are two types of people, noblemen and peasants. But if you're very simple example again, but if you're digging deeper, you may see, oh, no, they're different. Actually, noblemen aren't a homogeneous group. There are different types of noblemen that play different roles in my research. So the categories that you use to define or classify the persons you're dealing with evolves over time. And of course, this makes it very difficult to say, well, okay, let's all gather and create a standard for categorizing historical persons. This will not work. But on the other hand, the current situation that everybody does his or her own categorization is also unsatisfactory, because you can't exchange data. You can say, well, I've created a database of 500 medieval persons, and they are all classified according to some criteria. But your fellow researcher may not be able to use this, because this classification doesn't make any sense to him. And the labeling system is an approach where we try to mitigate this problem by using what we call a reference thesaurus, which is basically some intermediate thesaurus that you, instead of writing a natural language definition, you refer to some common thesaurus, which may not be as detailed as it could be, but which gives you some kind of anchor where you can connect to something to some other person's research. And instead of another important aspect here is that instead of just using one label, you assign basically assign a number, a bundle of concepts to the labels you use. So it's you say this has something. Okay, we call this X, and this X has something to do with this, and it has something to do with this, and it has something to do with this. So this may the association between the label and the concepts in the reference thesaurus may be relatively vague, but at least they give you some way to match other people's categorization schemes as well. Here's a third example of some ongoing work. We are trying, the Leibniz Institute of European History has a database of early modern European peace treaties. And it was actually created at some point in the 90s, and it's and that's what it looks like currently. It's very useful research tool, but unfortunately you can't use it in any other way but browsing it and reading it as a human. And what we're trying to do is to convert this to linked open data, so that we have a formal model of the peace treaties, which makes it explicit who were the powers involved, who signed the treaties, what territories were covered by this treaties, and these kinds of things. And while doing this, you notice that the data collected back in the 1990s, it was not as good as you hoped it would be, and so we are currently putting much effort into cleaning this data and enriching this data so that it can be actually useful. And the last example that I'm going to show and is also some ongoing work in Daria project, this time in collaboration with computer scientists at the University of Bamberg. The Cosmo tool, and actually has some NLP component to it. The idea here of this tool is to support biographical research, so research into the lives of persons with a computational tool. And this tool we have a formal model of form a biographical model, a model of a person's life, which you, and you can see on the left-hand side, you can see a visualization of this model, which is basically a timeline with events that happen in that person's life. And these events are also are linked to dates and places, obviously. And what this tool does is it's currently based on structured on structured information from that comes from Wikidata, and on unstructured information that comes from Wikipedia, from the full text of biographical articles in Wikipedia. And the interesting thing here is bringing these two types of information together. So it's of course it's easy to use structured information such as date of birth, place of death, and these kinds of things that you find in Wikidata. But you do not find everything of interest in Wikidata. Some of it, some of the important biographical information is only mentioned in the full text of the Wikipedia article. So what we are doing here is combining these two sources of information. But we're doing it in a way that is useful for historians who need to know where the information comes from. So in this timeline, I hope you can see it in the in or at least have an idea some idea in the back of the room. You see boxes of different colors and in different positions, and these the color and the position the horizontal position indicates where this information comes from and how reliable this is. So we treat structured information as reliable because we don't know that we know that there is at least no transmission error. Of course, the date given may still be wrong, but there's no transmission or interpretation error. And we treat information gained from parsing the natural language text of the Wikipedia article as less reliable because there may be errors in parsing, or not everything maybe identified correctly, and this is indicated by these colors and the position on this line, and the historian can then click on these pieces of information which are actually parts of the formal model, and see where this in this area where this information comes from the exact for example the sentence in Wikipedia that states that the address of the house in Frankfurt where Goethe in this context was born. And then can evaluate this information and decide whether this is trustworthy or not. And in the future version, or what we are doing now in the third phase of DARIA-DE actually is that we want to do evaluation on, or allow historians to do evaluations on large collections of these biographical models in order to identify connections, interesting connection or interesting events. For example, if you have a large number of such models, you could discover, for example, that a certain person was at some time, at some place where some other person was as well. And this is often information that is not known because it's hidden in some biographical entries, and you may then find that these two persons meet again at some later point in time, and so their first meeting may have been instrumental to their second meeting, and this may be interesting for all kinds of historical research questions. Okay. but this is ongoing work. What we currently have is the automatic creation of these biographical profiles, we call them, but these are actually formal models of people's lives. We're currently working on comparing these models, and we also want to expand this from biographies to the history of ideas. Because you could say, well, ideas similar have biographies that in some ways resemble the biographies of people, because they arise at some time and they are spread over a geographical area, or they move between different places and they are picked up and then they move something somewhere else. Or so these are currently just vague ideas, and we're trying to do something in that area. So, to summarize, I think, or I strongly believe that the digital humanities do not merely aim to accelerate research or to analyze larger amounts of data. Because I don't think that this actually, acceleration is nice, and it's nice to have access to digitized sources at any time of the day or the night, but it does not actually advance scholarship in a significant way. So there must be more to it. And I think the key is formal modeling of scholarly knowledge and insights in a machine processable form. Because formal models increase coherence, precision, and explicitness, and they encourage cooperation and sharing, and they help researchers to directly build upon each other's work. And I think if, as computational linguists, you would know that this is actually true in computational linguistics. You have corpora, for example, that are reused by other people for doing their kinds of research, and this, of course, is based on formal models of annotation that you can actually share and reuse. And we currently don't have the. Of course, there are some limits to it, but it works much better than in the humanities. So that's why I believe that knowledge representation techniques are the foremost tools for creating formal models in the humanities. And the ongoing and seemingly never-ending discussion about what the digital humanities are can benefit from studying the development of linguistics, I think. And the digital humanities subfields or applied digital humanities can benefit from studying corpus linguistics as some way of applied computational linguistics. It's not concerned with formal languages, but with the application of these of these modeling techniques to some concrete research questions in linguistics. And if we talk about natural language processing from the point of history, it should be considered an auxiliary science, and as such, scholars have to get acquainted with its methods and tools. And with this, I close my talk, and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you. So, first question.
Or comment. If you disagree, feel free to say so.
Thank you.
Maybe one question. I think that one of the most important points in the development of linguistics to formal linguistics was the ability of running experiments, mm-hmm. Running and evaluating. While you can, it's hard to do anything similar in mm-hmm. in history, unless, or at least not in the democratic countries.
Yes.
So, is it limiting, or can you avoid the need for experiments somehow if you want to evaluate the quality of hypotheses?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is obviously a good point, and it shows that while there are similarities, there are also differences to between history and linguistics, for example. And of course, you cannot evaluate the quality of historical models in the same way as you can evaluate the quality of linguistic models, such as grammars, for example. You apply them to a corpus, and then you see what the coverage is, for example. of course you can't do this, and I think this is exactly why knowledge representation is the most important part here, because you also need to you're not dealing with facts, but you're dealing with interpretation of information gained from historical documents, and you may legitimately differ in your opinion. So what we also need to represent is to say, well, scholar A said that this is the case, but I, or scholar B, disagrees on the grounds of some other document, for example, or on the grounds of some other information gained from other sources. If you consider historical research, for example, this is the way that you can test and refine your models. You cannot run experiments, obviously, but you can support the discussion. So this is actually of course what is being done today already, but it's a very slow process, and people often get caught in discussions about terminology without making any progress. But if you're dealing I think you still have the same discussion process, but I think the discussion process is much very much supported by having formal models, because then you can exactly pinpoint what the problem is. You can say I agree with that part, but I don't agree with that part, and my own suggestion would be this, and then you don't need to discuss whatever the terminology used, but you can exactly pinpoint the parts you disagree with, and then of course other researchers would be able to see, oh, there's some disagreement here. I have to make a choice. Do I support this view or this view, or do I have a third view? So this would be my answer to it. Of course, you can't run experiments, so you need something else.
Following question.
Okay, thank you very much.